You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Roy Blunt Jr. is the author of 22 books and a regular panelist on the NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Besides his work as a humorist, he has been named a New York Public Library Literary Lion and a Boston Public Library Literary Light, and he serves as a usage consultant on the American Heritage Dictionary. His latest book is called Alphabetter Juice, or The Joy of Text. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Roy Blunt Jr. back to our show. Hi.
Great to see you. It's good to be here.
Is this the sequel to Alphabet Juice, which was published just a couple of years ago?
Yeah, it is.
You had just had too many words you couldn't fit
well
in the first
words
book?
Came flooding to me, and that book, I've literally been collecting notes for this book since I was in high school. I've got all these old notebooks that I wrote down little things about words that I liked and why I liked them and etymologies and stuff. And I always wanted to do a book of some kind. And I finally had a kind of hook when I was reading a linguistics text which said the relation between words and their meaning is arbitrary. And that got my back up because to me words have a lot of intrinsic value that carry meaning.
Well, there are onomatopoeic words,
right?
But you're saying other ones as well.
Yeah, I mean there are also. I mean, people will grant you that snap, crackle, and pop are onomatopoeic, but there's a lot subtler level of onomatopoeia. And I would use another word, sonicky or kinephonic, which is a combination not just of sound, combination of sound, and also the kinetics of how words move through your mouth.
You made up the word sonicky.
Sonicky, yeah, I did. Yeah.
And give me a sonicky word.
Well, sneer, sprawl, there are just millions of, the word squelch. People will say, well, that's onomatopoeia, but I tested it out. I stepped on a lot of different things, and none of them made that. I actually accidentally stepped on a hamster when I was in college, and I can tell you, I can still hear that sound, and it wasn't squelch. But what squelch does is it starts out with a little hiss, and then it presses your tongue up against the roof of your mouth, like lots of other S-Q-U words. Nearly every S-Q-U word, squint, squeeze, squeal, has something, tight, squib, squiggle. So it has to do with what the tongue somehow capturing the way you try to capture meaning with your hands, That's how language surely began with the tongue.
Well, you mentioned skimp.
Skimp, yeah.
But skimp, we could, the reason we think of it as having some kind of a suggestive meaning is because of scrimp, I would think. But we could also think of it as being related to peanut butter, couldn't we?
Skippy, yeah. Well, Skippy. Skimp and skip are a little different. But I'm not saying, but okay, compare splurge and skimp. I mean, if it's arbitrary, then splurge could serve just as well.
No, splurge does sound
splurge,
an explosion.
Skimp is tight.
Oh, were you the kind of kid who read dictionaries when you were a kid?
I did, and encyclopedia. I mean, I looked things up in the dictionary. But also, my mother taught me to read phonetically, sound out the words. And also, she read to me, and I would look over her shoulder, Winnie the Pooh and also Uncle Remus stories, which were in dialect. And I could see that you could spell differently from the dictionary.
And you cite a 17th century lexicographer named Thomas Blunt.
That's right.
Who wrote a dictionary he called Glossographia.
Yeah.
Was he a relation?
Well, I claim him. He's an ancestor. I mean, my people came over from England a long time ago. So, he was one of the first etymologists. And it's kind of a quotable dictionary. It's written in the 17th century. And I actually held leafed through a copy of it in the New York Public Library.
Well, do you think that one of the reasons you have an interest in language is that you have a frequently mispronounced name?
Yeah, that's right.
People say Blount.
People say Blount, and I can't really blame them. I mean, after all, if pronounce was pronounced the way my name is, it would be pronounced pronounce. And I wouldn't, and nobody would want to do that. So, but it's an old English pronunciation, and I don't want to change it just because. And there are a lot of other Blunts around. Mel
Blunt. It's a sonicky name, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I guess it is. I don't know how blunt I am, but it's a sonicky word. You wouldn't want to, expansive sounds doesn't sound like blunt, and blunt doesn't sound like expansive.
So when Mel Blunt came along, Did you? It's unlikely that there's too much of a family connection.
Well, I wrote a book about the Steelers, and I got to know Mal Blount very well, and I went down with him to his farm and asked around, and he, you know, probably was a Blount family who owned his family at some point. But he said, just think, your great-great-granddaddy owned my great-great-granddaddy. And I thought, oh, God, I hope not. So I asked my father, and he said, no, your great-great-granddaddy didn't own Mel's great-great-granddaddy because your great-great-granddaddy didn't own anything. So I felt relieved.
But we were too poor to have slaves.
That's right. I'm sure they would have if they could have. But I did look into the other side of Mel's family, which, oddly enough, his maternal grandfather's side, the Sharps, and Charlie Sharp was a legendary person down there who was born in slavery and accumulated something like 12,000 acres of land by buying it at a nickel an acre.
And this book is put together with entries similar to the way a dictionary would be put together.
It's alphabetical. It gave me a structure. I'm not very structured, so it's great to have the alphabet as a structure.
And these are just words that caught your fancy?
Yeah.
Fox catches your fancy?
Fox, yeah. I was interested in fox because because Oscar Wilde said fox hunting is the unspeakable in pursuit of the inedible. And I thought, why can't you eat a fox? So I looked into that.
And you can't?
Some people have, but I guess it's kind of strong meat. But I found a recipe for fox chili or something like that. So people have eaten it.
I suspect there are a few things out there that people have not eaten.
Very few, yes. Certainly, I've been to China, and I've seen I saw a man in China making snake tartare. He had a live snake. He was grinding it up, tail first, and that was an irritated snake, I can tell you.
Roy Blount Jr.'s book, Alphabetterjuice, or The Joy of Text, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. What is your feeling about puns? Because you talk about them here as well. How do you respond to people like William Shawn, who just hated them?
I don't see how you can love words and hate puns. I mean, they're bad puns. They're lame puns. But Cole Porter, I quote see if I remember it now. Cole Porter lyric, which someone sings, my will is strong, but my want is weak. I love puns.
Well, you mentioned Oscar Wilde before. One of my favorite wordplays of his is he said, champagne for my real friends, real pain for my sham friends.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good one.
Very witty, isn't it?
Yeah.
And puns, you know, I mean, puns do get groans. Uh-huh. But when you think of the really good ones, like Chico Marx's response to somebody saying Eureka, he said, you don't smell it so good of yourself.
That's right, yeah.
Well, Clifton Fadiman said something like, don't beat a dead dog but with a stigma. I mean, that's real wit, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's fun. And, you know, the Algonquin roundtablers used to play that game where they would think of a pun like most famously, Dorothy Parker said you can took the word horticulture and said you can lead a horticulture, but you can't make her think. Mm-hmm. And then George S. Kaufman had one with Demosthenes. He said, Demosthenes can do is hold the legs together or something like that.
Well, so why do you think people groan?
Well, I don't mind groaning. I mean, groaning is kind of a tribute, I think. I don't know. I think people call it the lowest form of wit, but I've seen lots lower. There's vomit wit. Last night we saw the movie Bridesmaids, which was really good, except there's this huge, long digestive explosion scene with everybody throwing up on each other.
Yeah, I understand that was imposed.
Yeah,
by Judd Apatow.
Yeah, and it's a nice romantic comedy otherwise. But
your wife is an artist.
She is.
Do you think that artists have a different way of relating to words?
Yeah, relating to words, of relating to the world, certainly. She sees things more than I do. But she likes words, and I think that I like the texture of words and the feel of words. And
physicality.
And she's a very brushy painter. So I think I'm a little more, I'm more finicky and fiddly than she is, but I try by rewriting to capture the kind of dash and splash that she has.
I wonder if you can read a couple of these entries to us. For example, in your entry for first sentence, you discuss the first sentence of Karl Rove's book, Courage and Consequence, My Life as a Conservative in the Fight.
Yeah. Yeah, he cited, well, I'll read.
Page 73, by the way.
Oh, thanks. It's under first, I guess, instead of sentence first. Generally, an author takes great pains with the first sentence of his or her book. I know I have never been quite satisfied with any of mine. But then I've never had all the ranks of assistance available to Karl Rove, author of Courage and Consequence, My Life as a Conservative in the Fight. Rove acknowledges an editor, a, quote, close friend and trusted former colleague who, quote, also helped craft every chapter and episode, a line editor, a researcher, seven research assistants under the, quote, expert guidance of yet another person, and his chief of staff, and 22 people who read important parts of the manuscript, and 10 more people who, quote, devoured and improved major swatches of this manuscript.
Devoured?
Yeah, it's an interesting process, devouring and improving. Maybe something like free-range chickens.
Well, we're back to that scene in Bridesmaids.
I know, aren't we? There we are. Right, right.
Then you throw the whole thing up.
Yeah. They turn it into high-quality manure is what they did. But here's the opening sentence of Karl Rove's book. On September 11, 2001, I was the first person to tell President George W. Bush that a plane had slammed into an office tower in New York City and was aboard Air Force One as it crisscrossed the country in the hours that followed. What he's saying is that the plane slammed into the tower, and then the plane was aboard Air Force One as it, you know, it's the next sentence is nothing to write home about.
So either. None of those editors really.
None of those people caught that. People caught that. The first sentence. You know, you got to get your first sentence right.
And what's the second sentence you said?
Well, I just said it's nothing to write home about either, but it's at least roughly grammatical.
Well, do you think that it was something that's happened in political discourse in general? Abe Lincoln, who we probably think was the greatest orator,
right.
And maybe our greatest president, he wrote everything for himself, didn't he?
He was a real writer, yeah.
And then FDR wrote a lot of his own speeches.
And Obama,
and Ted Sorensen wrote a lot of good speeches.
Ted Sorensen wrote, some awfully good ones. Abe Lincoln learned to write by reading books instead of listening to other politicians. And, you know, other politicians then who were talking had also learned to use language by reading books. So people were more if they were literate, they were more literary then than they are now.
Well, we haven't had too many inspiring speakers as presidents, the Bush administration did seem to be one of the worst. Do you think that there was any reason for that?
I think...
You could hire a great speechwriter, and it doesn't matter whether you can write good speeches or not, just deliver beautiful speeches.
Well, but you it's a matter of your idea of what a beautiful speech is. I mean, the person delivering it, I'm sure George Bush thought he was delivering beautiful speeches. He just didn't have, and also he just had a simplistic mind, you know, good and evil and not much nuance, and therefore his speeches weren't as interesting as Obama's, for instance.
Well, you are revealing your political biases, right. Something we don't do on public radio. But
I'm just a guest, though. I'm not policy.
Do you think that how much does language reveal about the way we use language reveal about us? There are people on both left and right who use it quite beautifully.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And I'm quite conservative with regard to language. I like for language for the value to be held on to in language. I believe that any time you use disinterested to mean uninterested, an angel dies.
I know what you mean. Roy Blunt Jr. is the author of 22 previous books. This is his 23rd, and they cover subjects from the Pittsburgh Steelers to Robert E. Lee to What Dogs Are Thinking. His latest is Alpha Better Juice, The Joy of Text. It's published by Farris, Strauss, and Giroux, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Roy Blunt Jr., whose latest book, A Compendium of Words, is called Alpha Better Juice, or The Joy of Text, and it's published by Farris, Strauss, and Giroux. We got a comment from one of our listeners, Phoebe in Bushwick, who says, I've always disliked the word mauve because it sounds so unlike the color it describes.
Hmm.
What is it, mauve?
I thought it was mauve.
Mauve, maybe.
Either way, yeah. I mean, There's a whole book about mauve, I believe, oddly enough. Well, you know, words that I don't know what mauve comes from. I ought to.
Well, it sounds like purple prose to me.
Yeah,
so.
I don't mind mauve. Mauve sort of moves me a bit. But words from French words are different. The most sonic-y words in English are from Germanic or Dutch Scandinavian roots somehow or another. They have a lot of work or a lot of gristle in them.
Words like cow and pig.
Well, no, words like, now I got to think of some words. Words like dumb and squelch and jump. Well, a lot of words, nobody knows where jump came from. It didn't come along until the 16th century.
Really?
Yeah, before there was leap and spring, which are quite different words, actually. But jump came from Norway, and it just jumped into our can. And people, there's speculation. I mean, some etymologists will say that, well, some people say the ump part has to do with the sound of people landing from a jump, and therefore it may be imitative. But I think the J part is, there's all these kinds of jab and jump and jitter that have the J carries a charge in English.
Hey, you're from, talking about the J sound, Georgia.
Yeah.
Obviously sound like a Southerner, despite the fact that you've lived in the Northeast for much of your life.
1968, yeah.
But I wonder about the whole business of displacement and language.
Mm. Well, certainly I grew up sounding different from people on TV and on the radio, you know. And it's like immigrants, a lot of immigrant writers tended to be conscious of the language and to get a lot of comic juice out of the language because they spoke differently from standard English, and they made hay out of that. And
Nabokov became one of the greatest stylists in the English language.
Joseph Conrad. Yeah, and Chico Marx, as we were just saying.
Well, he went back and forth.
Yeah.
Do you think that you still have that Southern sensibility? Are there Southern expressions you still use?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's people accuse me of keeping my accent, but I never wanted to lose all of it. I've lost some of it, but I think that part of my sensitivity and my sensitivity to and appreciation of words comes from the Southern. Southerners tend to, it's an oral culture. Southerners tend to like to roll words around in their mouth and derive sonic effect from words, and as do African Americans and Irish and Yiddish is full of all sorts of sonic-y stuff. Kvetch, if you ever looked into the etymology of kvetch, it's quite interesting.
Well, do you think that that's a reason, that oral tradition, that the South produced so many great writers, at least for a time, not anymore for some reason?
I have several answers to why the South produced a lot of great writers. One is that they didn't have all that many readers, so you could write about your neighbors and they didn't know. But, yeah, I think that...
You mean if Flannery O'Connor's neighbors knew what she was writing,
nobody
they would have been horrified?
Nobody knew, yeah, until later. In fact, there's a funny thing. Flannery O'Connor's mother came to Flannery O'Connor and said, "Who is this Kafka? I keep hearing that you're Kafka-esque. Who is this Kafka?" And Flannery O'Connor said, "Well, he was a German Jewish writer who wrote about turning into a cockroach." And her mother said, "I can't tell people that."
But why do you think it stopped? There were so many.
Yeah, well, there's still some. I mean, still some really good writers. There's Charles Portis in Arkansas, who wrote True Grit, is one of my favorite writers.
Mm. He's in hiding.
He doesn't come out much, but he writes. At any rate, Southern writing has tended to have a real oral charge to it, and that Southern writers like to capture the sound on the page, which is what I like. And Ernest Hemingway said all of modern American literature began with a book by Mr. Mark Twain called Huckleberry Finn. And Huckleberry Finn really laid down the template of American narrative by combining several forms of the vernacular with formal English.
Because he was from Missouri. I'm not sure. Is that a Southern?
Well, he was conceived in Tennessee, as one of my professors used to say. And his father fought in the Confederacy for 2 weeks and then lit out for the territory. So I think somebody called him the least Southern Southerner that they knew, but he was...
Well, earlier in your career, you wrote for Sports Illustrated, didn't you?
Yeah.
Does sports writing, well, you, sports writing is one of the entries in the book. Why does that wind up getting its own entry?
In this case, I was just complaining about some little trope in sports writing, but I've written a lot about sports writing in the past. It tends to be, for one thing, the other day I was reading in one of the tabloids, after Derek Jeter went 4-for-6, they said, Derek's comfortable now. He's as comfortable as if he were sitting on a lawn chair next to the pool. And I thought, come on, do better than that. Sports writing is a license to overstate. You know, surely you can, I don't know, Derek is as comfortable as if he were up to his neck in suds. I don't know. There must be something better than that.
But why does sports writing lend itself so much to metaphors?
Well, partly because it's done with the hands and a stick and a ball, and it's a very physical thing, and it's also a game, so you don't have to... You don't have to worry too much about taste, and you can just try to capture. And it's a physical activity. You talk to people you sit next to on the plane, and you ask them what they do, and they say, "Well, I interface with OPCOM over it." You know,
and I liaise.
That's right. They don't know what they do either. But if you ask, talk to football player about, you know, he'll show you his little finger, and he said, "I got this finger caught in Fran Tarkenton's shoulder blades, and shoulder pads. He was pulling me along by the seat, and it'll just swivel all the way around there."
Well, it's interesting how different athletes are from the rest of us. I saw an article in the Times the other day about all of the players who were undrafted but who would have been likely to have been invited to camps. And one of the guys said, "I'm so unhappy, I just have to hit somebody."
That isn't funny, is it? But somehow it is.
I don't know. It sounded so much like the side of football that we don't want to think about. Not that people don't hit each other, but you don't want to think somebody's actually enjoying it.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't do it if you didn't sort of enjoy it, I think. I mean, you get hit. Yeah, and, well, there's a terrible stigma or cloud over football now, as if there wasn't. Which is that we're finding out that more and more football players have suffered brain damage from...
And now hockey players as well.
Yeah.
Roy Blunt Jr., his latest book, Alpha Better Juice, or The Joy of Text, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Kurt in Manhattan has written in, how about words like pulchritude, which sound the opposite of what they mean?
Yeah, pulchritude doesn't work for me either. Interestingly, here's the thing, beautiful. There was somebody who was running an online dating service said that when people are getting to know each other online, they are put off by words like beautiful and cutie. So they prefer to hear words like cool or fascinating when you're first getting to know each other back and forth. But beautiful and cutie turn people off. It causes those words like that cause people to say ew. And ew.
Why is beautiful?
Well, that's what I try to figure out. For one thing, ew is in beautiful and in cutie. Hmm. And I think maybe there's something about you, that sound, which is wee backwards, I'm just a little, that is a little too intimate too soon or something.
Hmm. And you don't or intimidating initially.
Yeah, right.
Can I live up to a beautiful cutie?
Yeah, it's too much too soon.
You have covered considerable ground in your career. You've written books, screenplays, lyrics, acted in TV shows and movies, and performed in your own one-man show. How do you decide what you're going to do next?
I haven't decided what I'm going to do next, as a matter of fact. I'd love to write another word book. I don't know. Things just come along, and I've been making a living doing various things. I never wanted to get stuck in one groove. And there never has been a groove deep enough for me to get stuck in.
So you do a little bit of everything? You're still performing with the Rock Bottom Remainders?
Yeah, I mean, I do that maybe once a year. But yeah, I always liked, for some reason, I've always liked utility players and people, writers who've done lots of different things. Like James Agee wrote a novel and a play and a long journalistic work, and he wrote poetry. Oliver Goldsmith. There's a list of various people who wrote one. Graham Greene wrote a biography and a novel and a movie. So I always like the idea of being versatile, and it also has enabled me to make a living.
Well, James Agee made his living writing film reviews for Time magazine. Do you make your living being on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me?
No, but that's the thing that's probably the most successful and among the least lucrative things I've ever been involved in.
And I'll bet it takes up a lot of your time because you really have to keep up with the news.
Yeah, well, I just do it once a month. But when I started doing it 13 years ago, I thought this is a great excuse for reading the paper as much as I do. And now I have to read it even more the week that I'm on. But you can't really prepare for it because they find strange stories that I don't know where they find them. But so I have to go online and read FARC.com and things like that, and it just wears me out.
And then you said you're with the Rock Bottom Remainders just once a year. What instrument do you play?
Well, that's the thing. I introduce the band, and I sort of do some eccentric dancing in the background if I've had a couple.
So you don't have to really prepare.
No, I don't have to prepare. I also come in on Wild Thing. I come in on You Move Me. That's my solo.
And the band includes a whole bunch of
Stephen King, Dave Barry, and Amy Tan, and Mitch Albom, and Scott Turow, and Ridley Pearson. It's a great group. We've been together for 20 years now.
And that's a weird range of literature.
It is.
April called in and said the reason that she thinks there aren't as many writers in the South is air conditioning, because
well, that's right.
That advance, before that advance, everyone would sit around and talk and drink. Also, she says she doesn't buy into the notion that all Southerners are racist. Many, like herself, were involved in the civil rights movement. Did we suggest that all Southerners
are racist? No, I certainly did not suggest that.
We know it's not true.
No, yeah. I mean,
but most of them were.
Quite a few. The system was, I'll tell you that, but it wasn't so great up here either.
That's true. In fact, we just talked yesterday about what happened during and after the Civil War. And, the abolitionists were considered an annoyance.
You're right.
And people burned down a meeting in Boston.
Yeah. The North, the Republican Party sold out the African Americans early on. And it wasn't just the deal in 1876 that everybody talks about. Emancipation was not a popular program even in the North.
You were the president of the Authors Guild in 2009. What did that job entail?
I was president for 4 years. It entailed writing a column for nothing every other month, oddly enough, but it entailed helping to negotiate with Google during the long attempt to settle our suit against Google, which went on and on and on, and then got thrown out by the court. So,
and you wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times back then protesting the fact that Amazon wasn't paying authors for the rights to the Kindle audio versions of their books.
Right.
Has that changed?
No. I mean, they're still not paying for it. But
Do you own a Kindle or an e-book?
The Authors Guild bought me one so I could try it. I haven't, and I don't like the Kindle, but I do like the iBook pretty much. I mean, iPad. I mean, I bought my own book on the iPad so that I could read from it. But I would be reading when I'm on this book tour. I was in Philadelphia. I had my iPad in front of me. I had it all set up. But then I started putting my hand down on the iPad in the wrong place, and it would jump to page 480 or jump to some completely different book. And so it's tippy. It's unstable, that iPad. But I've read now two novels by Laura Lippman on my iPad and enjoyed them very much.
Well, one of the problems for many writers is they start correcting the text when they do readings. Realize that they would have preferred to have had a different verb in there. Right. And you can't do that with the iPad.
It's hard to do it. Anyway, maybe you can. I don't know. There may be some way to somehow stick things in. But I don't know. I once saw Pauline Kael reading one of her protege's reviews on a screen, and he had shown it to her on an iPad. I mean, a laptop screen, and she had a pencil in her hand, and she kept trying to change it, and he kept saying, "No." I like a pencil more than a touchpad.
Well, do you think computers are changing everything? First of all, we have spell check, and now with iPhones, you could be typing a perfectly reasonable word, and they correct you.
Yeah, change it. I know it. I hate that. So my wife just disempowered my spell check from my iPad. In fact, thank goodness.
You have to ask your wife to do those things.
Yeah, she's younger than I am, and she's an artist, so she's visual. I'm just too cranky. I yell at it. I tend to yell at electronic devices. And sometimes it works to yell at them, but it doesn't work to yell at them.
What are your thoughts on the fact that the web enables anyone to publish these days?
Well, it means there's a lot of crap out there, certainly. but they're, you know, it's just that publishing, if nobody sees it, is not exactly publishing. But it's great. I didn't coin this word, but on Urban Dictionary, you go on urbandictionary.com, it's a website. On that, I define the word Googledipity, which is, serendipity on the Google. And you just take it. I was trying to think of something. I had seen a news story that involved seeing an enormous S from the air. And I couldn't remember what the story was, so I just Googled enormous S, and the strangest things came up. Yeah, all sorts of strange things. There's just strange stuff out there on the Google. The Google is. But also it leads to, I Googled the thing in the Harvard Magazine, a guy talking about, so he wrote in a query saying, my mother used to say something like, something, something, something in the uffum, buffum, wuffum. I don't know. See, this thing his mother used to say around the house. Has anybody else heard that? And he said it's ungooglable. But since it was in Harvard Magazine, it now is googlable. So I Googled it, and there was his statement that is self-refuting to publish something as ungooglable. But then that took me to it also led me over to Robert Buffum, who was one of the earliest Medal of Honor winners. Because he, the great locomotive chase, the Buster Keaton movie, he was in the real event of capturing a Confederate locomotive. And there's a long, wonderful story about Robert Buffum, which I tracked down. I just love Googledipity.
Mm-hmm. Well.
Then there's OED Dipity, too, which sounds sort of edible, but it's the Oxford English Dictionary Dipity.
So what are you working on next, Alphabest Juice?
I would like to do Alphabest Juice. If this book does well enough, then maybe Farrar Straus will encourage me to do Alphabest Juice. The last line of this book is, I hope I'll see you in Alphabest Juice. But then that would have to be the end of it. So maybe I need to do Alpha Mo Better Juice or something before I get to Alphabest.
Well, Alpha Better Juice, or The Joy of Text, has just been published by Farrar Straus and Giroux. Coffee just went down the wrong way. That happens to me all the time on the air, Roy. Roy Blunt Jr. Roy Blunt Jr., thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Lee. It's been great.